You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. It was a crime unlike anything seen in British Columbia. The horror of the Wells Gray murders almost 40 years ago transcends decades. On August 2, 1982, three generations of a family set out on a camping trip. Bob and Jackie Johnson, their two daughters Janet, 13, and Karen, 11, and Jackie's parents, George and Edith Bentley. A month later, the Johnson family car was found off a mountainside logging road near Wells Gray Park, completely burned out. In the back seat were the incinerated remains of four adults, and in the trunk were the two girls. But this was not just your average mass murder. It was much worse. Over time, some brutal details were revealed. However, most are still only known to the murderer, David Ennis, formerly Shearing. His crimes had far-reaching impacts on the family, community, and country. It still does today. Every time Shearing attempts freedom from the parole board, the grief is triggered as everyone is forced to relive the horrors once again. Time 6 shines a spotlight on the crime that captured the attention of a nation, recounts the narrative of a complex police investigation, and discusses whether a convicted mass murderer should ever be allowed to leave the confines of an institution. Most importantly, it tells the story of one family forever changed. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murder, Time 6, The True Story of the Wells Gray Park Murders, with my special guest journalist, author, and radio host, Alan R. Warren. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Alan R. Warren.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you very much for this. Congratulations on this new book, Murder, Time 6. Tell us how you came to want to write Murder, Time 6.
Well, you know, I get asked that sort of question all the time. I was in Kelowna. It's a town in British Columbia in the interior. And I have a place here, and so I was up here for near Christmas time, and there's a hair salon in town that always buys my books, and I had a couple of new ones, so I dropped by just before and to give them some of my books. There's three different girls there that buy them, and the owner came up to me and asked me why I've never written about this Shearing case, the Wells Gray murders. And I said, well, you know, I've never heard of it, not being from Kelowna originally. And she kind of explained some of it and some of the details and that there was a aquatic center in the western side of the city that was dedicated to the family. And so I thought, wow, this is, geez. So when I went home, I kind of looked it up and kind of put it aside. And, you know, I always have four or five stories going at a time. And when I located family members, I sent them, you know, letters or emails and stuff, and just to see what they thought about a book being written and if they would be interested and if they wanted to be involved. And the response was really good. It seemed like everybody was on board. And so with such a positive sort of feedback, I thought, well, let's start on this then. And that's how it all started.
Now take us back and to Bob Johnson, 44-year-old man, and his wife, Jackie, 41 years old. And they had two daughters, Janet, which was 13, and Karen, 11. And they had planned to go to Jasper National Park in Alberta with Jackie's parents, George, and Edith Bentley. And George was 66 years old, and Edith Bentley was 59 years old. And George had just retired from his job in a lumber mill and bought a brand-new heavy-duty 1981 silver Ford pickup truck with a 10-foot Vanguard over the cab camper and hung an outdoor motor on the back. Tell us about this family trip and where they were eventually going. We mentioned Jasper National Park, but tell us where this trip, camping trip, took them to, and tell us a little bit more about the Johnson and Bentley families.
Well, yeah, the Johnsons lived in West Kelowna, and back then, and it was just a small town outside of Kelowna, just called West Bank, so it wasn't part of the city. As a family, they used to do everything outdoors, you know, camping, fishing, snowboarding, snow, everything, just anything, any chance to get away they could. And where they lived, you know, especially back then, you drove for 10, 15 minutes, you were in the woods.
Right.
So that's kind of them. And the father worked at Gorman Mills, which he had been at for quite a while and had a really good reputation. The two daughters were in school. And they in their house, they had his parents living downstairs. They were helping to take care of them. And, yeah, so this trip was really kind of the summer vacation, take 2 weeks off and go up to the park and go fishing and spend time together. And they loved doing that. Wells Gray Park is a very popular park in the interior. But they sort of were more to themselves, and they weren't as big into going right into the main park campsite and hanging out with everybody. They would go kind of to the outskirts. They would look for kind of a quieter, more private place, and that's what they did. So they went and found that. And initially, there were going to be more members of the family going. They were going to kind of meet up in the Jasper area, and then go to Wells Gray from there. But a couple of the other family members decided they had some other things to do, and there was something that kind of a wedding of a friend that they thought they'd go to. So a lot of them went their own direction. So it was just the six members of this family.
Now, this Wells Gray Park, tell us a little bit about how big this park is and the kind of park it really is. And you mentioned that they really wanted the family to get away from popular, I guess, camping sites. So they picked Grayswell Park for that reason as well. But tell us a little bit more about the park itself.
Well, the park is a really popular park, especially back then. It was kind of the place to go in the interior of BC. So, you know, you're kind of between Vancouver and Calgary, the two big cities. You're a good couple hundred miles away from either one. So it's a really good location, and great weather, lots of wildlife and fishing, and just everything you could think of was there. So it's I think it's the third largest park in Canada, if I remember right. So very, very big park, very nice, beautiful area. And that was sort of their idea. And you know, like I said, instead of being in the center of the park, they kind of went out and looked for just any place that was flat and available to camp. And that's sort of what they found. They found a nice secluded place close to the fishing, close to the river. And it was near an old abandoned prison site that was in the park. It had been closed down and most of it had fallen apart. There wasn't a whole lot left of it. But it was a really good flat ground area, so they could set the grandparents' camper up and on flat ground and set up the tent and everything. And it was, you know, have a big bonfire, and it was a perfect place.
Now, you talk about the Johnson family. They had packed up all of their belongings in their 1979 Plymouth Caravelle with a car top carrier, and they had left on August 2nd, 1982. The Bentleys had checked into a campsite 250 miles northwest of Calgary, like you had mentioned, August 8th, and then the Johnsons arrived on August 11th, and after that, they all headed to Wells Gray Park. So the grandparents, the parents, and the two girls, Janet and Karen. Now, they got to that park August 11th, and when they got there, like you mentioned, they found a secluded spot. So from everything, as you write in the book, what happened once they got there? They had the tents, sleeping bags, the camper. The adults were going to be in sleeping in the camper. Tell us what they did, and you talk about the grandmother wanting to make her favorite dish or favorite pie, pardon me.
Yeah, the family liked to spend a lot of time fishing and doing the campfire. It was just really a time to spend together and talk about their lives, and they're a very close family that way. So really, it was that's what it was about. It was very warm. It wasn't cloudy. It was a good time of the year to be there. And as for the grandmother, they would go out picking berries because she loved to make pies for everybody, and so that was kind of the key thing for them. So they were going to pick berries, and no real agenda, no real time frame. I think they kind of like to get lost in just being away from home and work, and just kind of, you know, just in that atmosphere of being a family and being together and camping and just enjoying each other and sitting around talking about things and things like that. It wasn't, like I said, there was no big strip, you know, just pick huckleberries and things like that.
You talk about that they had an uneventful, like you mentioned, a night. They set up quite easily. There wasn't much to do. The girls set up the tent. They had a night around the campfire. The next day, the girls ran in the woods and explored, likely swam. They were in their bathing suits, caught a small fish, you said. And so everybody was having a great time. And Bob was just the grandfather was just newly retired. So the thing is that they had another great day, but uneventful in terms of anybody coming around or seeing anybody, any intruders or any visitors whatsoever. They even roasted some marshmallows. So we'll say about the third night that they are there, what happens? As you read in the book, the girls are in the tent. And just from their perspective, what happens one night, again, when they're ready to go to bed, it's a little bit later, what happens?
Yeah, I played with the dates a little because talking to the killer and looking at the police reports and the family and kind of going through everything, I got a few different dates from everybody. So I kind of put it as second or third day. I was kind of loose on that. What had happened was the killer had watched the family for at least one night. And in his mind, he wanted to be with the two girls, the two young girls. And so he would have to eliminate the four adults. And so I guess he came up with a plan in his own mind of how he was going to do that. And on the night you were talking, the kids got put to bed in their tent, and the four adults were sitting around the campfire having a beer. I believe one was standing, and the killer, Shering, he came out and shot the adults, basically. I kind of explain how it happened and how he shot all four adults. And with the father he had shot in the neck first, and he was still alive and bleeding and was laying out on the ground. So he killed the other three adults, and then he went to the tent. And what he did with the girls in the tent is still, we don't know for sure, because he gave me a different story than he gave the police, who there was a lot of, you know, either way, he went into the tent, he spent time with them, And then when he came out with the girls, he was going to take them back to his place. He could see the father was making noise and still alive, so he shot him in the head. And that's right in front of the girls. And so anyway, he took the girls back to his place. And before he did put the adults in the back of the car at that time. And then he said he put the two girls in the front seat with him and drove back to his place. And again, that's a questionable thing as well.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, you talked about this because this is a very important part of this story, even though we've kind of stopped it and tried to explain it, in that David Ennis, well, former Schering, we'll call him David Schering, he talked about coming up to the campsite after he had observed the girls the night before. He had seen them originally, supposedly, and spotted the whole family coming home from work one day, then did this surveillance of them. Then he thought maybe he might have been hurt or something, so he came back. But what he did is he said he came there, one of the women stood up, likely Jackie Johnson, and he said, "Listen, I've got a gun, don't move," and he shot her. Then Bob Johnson seemed, it looked like, younger man, he said, stood up and he shot him. And then what's interesting is that the original story, and we haven't even got to anything yet, but the original story of when all is said and done is much different than the story we just told about how he shot the parents and the grandparents and then went in and likely sexually assaulted these girls, and then later they were killed. So we have a different story than the one that comes up at his trial and then later comes up according to Detective Eastham. So let's go back to what happens right after this murderous rampage of at least four people. What happens with work and with Bob Johnson? This is August the 23rd.
Right. So they had not showed up back home, and Bob Johnson had not showed up at work. So, the boss, who happened to be a really good friend, was a little bit concerned because that never happens, you know. And so he called home, and nobody knew anything, and he started searching around. And so he called the Kelowna Police Detachment and informed them about what was going on. And so eventually they realized that the family had not come back. There was nobody home, and something was gone, you know, gone wrong. Initially, in their minds, I think they were thinking, you know, they got broke down, something happened in that way, or they weren't thinking, of course, what had happened. That wasn't on their minds. It wasn't on anybody's minds initially. And so that's how that went. And then eventually they caught on and realized that there was something a little more going on. So it became concerning. And the police got involved, and they set up and they started doing their, some basic search in the parks and things like that for the family to see who had signed in and where and when, and try to locate where they were. And that's how that went. So that, I think that's the best I can say about that.
The first tip you write is from a local gas station near Clearwater, and an attendant there had seen the grandparents traveling with their two grandchildren. And they had asked if he knew of a good spot to pick these huckleberries, which was the grandmother's favorite. That led police onto a search, including help, like you had mentioned, from the community including private planes as well, and the search went on for weeks. On September 13th, you write, this is still 1982, a man, Kurt Crack, remembers seeing the Johnson vehicle when he was out picking mushrooms in the park in late August. And for some reason, he doesn't report it till September 13th, I think, because he just it wasn't available for him to, or he saw the report on the news later. For whatever reason, it's now September 13th, and he said he saw a burnt-out Chrysler in the woods just off Battle Mount Road. So the person that had been contacted is Sergeant Baruta. He heads to the location. Now, this is an old horseback riding trail, and they find tire marks. What do they find? What is this car, and is it the car that police are looking for?
Well, I think initially when they saw the tire tracks going off the road, and Baruta got there, I guess the initial thing was that he just saw an outline of what looked like a burnt out car, and even some of the police reports, the comments were that the first thought was just it was a rusted old abandoned car, mm-hmm. but he could see the license plate and read the numbers. And that's kind of when they connected it, that this was it. This was the car that was missing. This is the Bob Johnson and his wife's car. So they roped it off immediately, and then they got a hold of Easton, who's in Kamloops. Baruta was a Clearwater RCMP.
Right.
And then what they did, you know, and Easton was in charge of kind of the serious crime unit. So mm-hmm. murders and things like that. So when they got a hold of him, they said, well, we found the Johnson car, and you better get out here. And so that was it. So, of course, they got their unit together and headed out to find out what this was all about, what evidence they could find in the car and around the car.
So they looked in the back initially, and they didn't know how many bodies were in the back. They couldn't recognize how many were there, were bone fragments. So when Easton comes, he takes a look. He doesn't know either, but there's a key or a key ring in the trunk. Tell us eventually how many bodies they found, were determined, were established that they were in the back seat, and what did they find in the trunk?
Yeah, initially, Baruta and his team first knew there were bodies, or they had no idea how many or what was going on. So when Easton and the other team showed up, again, it was questionable. They didn't know how many people because it was all burnt out. The key ring and the key, the back part where you would put the key in of the trunk to open it was busted. So he had to pry it open with a crowbar. And inside of that, he found what they thought were probably two bodies, maybe one. It was questionable immediately. But, you know, once the skulls came together, they knew there was two in the back. They were also very small. And so they figured the two in the back were the children. Now, this is important because then the assumption was that the two in the back seat were Bob Johnson and Jackie. And so at that point, the grandparents were still missing. The camper, which belonged to the grandparents, was not around, or the boat or the motor and the whole thing. So at this point, they thought, okay, we've got four bodies. And we have to put a lookout for the grandparents and the camper. So that was kind of what it was at that point.
And it was interesting and very, very vivid description in the book as well, and very cinematic in terms of when Easton pried open the trunk with a crowbar, the girls' skulls were looking at them. One was shot in the back of the head, very much like the parents were shot, but there was a hole just over the left eye, and they took the bullet from that skull. And at that point, you write that Easton didn't know what happened. Eventually, it was confirmed that through dental records only, because there was no DNA at that time, that all of the people in that car were all of the four adults and the two girls were in the back, in the trunk. You write, too, that the Johnson and Bentley families, the surviving families, were forced into hiding as the media camped out in their yards. And people had high hopes that they'd be found okay. They had a funeral service 10 days after. But now there was the priority for police to try to, as you write, find the truck and camper, this 1981 very distinctive, brand-new truck with a 10.5-foot Vanguard camper. You provide a great photo in there. So it's also carrying an aluminum boat and an Evinrude motor on top of the camper. So this is a distinctive-looking vehicle. And so what do the police do? What's their plan to try to get people and tips about this vehicle?
Yeah, it was distinctive, and remember, it was in 81, and this is 82, so to them, this is like a brand-new truck and camper. So what they decided to do was get a duplicate as close to the exact same truck, camper, and boat that the grandparents had, and they decided they would drive it across Canada from Vancouver to Montreal and further. And they would stop in each center with it and talk to people and hand out, brochures and papers and try to get anybody to have a jogged memory, to try and get them to kind of go, oh, I remember seeing this, or I saw them, or something. They just want it, and plus they wanted to keep it in the spotlight, keep it in the news, because as with anything, things start to fade, right? And it no longer gets talked about in the news and people forget and it moves on, you know. So they want it to keep the attention of Canada, and they want it to keep attention of everybody in all these towns so that they might get some piece of information. They might hear something from someone that could lead them in the direction of possibly where this camper went, because in their mind, whoever did the killing had taken off, and they have at least the truck with them, if not the camper too. So they were searching for that.
You write as well, though, the real reason why they decided to do something so dramatic like this is because when they put out initially, they got tips on the missing truck. Before they hatched this idea about driving a replica across Canada, a BC resident called and said he saw two men get out of a truck at a gas station in the province of Saskatchewan, and it wasn't a family. And they ended up in the same restaurant as he, and they spoke French. And he described them as late 20s, long hair, and... So anyway, sketches were made because they thought this was a reliable tip. So that is part of the reason why they went to the outlandish or dramatic effort to bring this truck across Canada, with the hopes of somebody spotting or remembering seeing this truck somewhere along the line in their travels across Canada. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, for sure. They added that as well, hoping that maybe these two French speaking guys maybe would have sold the truck or the camper, or they'd had some sort of interaction with the mechanic or something down the road. They were hoping there was that could jog a memory as well, but it was just the whole scenario, the whole sight of a camper and truck coming into your town and had signs on it, and just the police talking to people. It was just they just wanted people to be talking about it.
You also write, too, that they received a lot of tips because of this novel idea about the truck. And they also got another really good tip. At least Eastham thought it was a great tip in Windsor, Ontario, where two men walked into a shop, needed their truck painted immediately, hung around the shop while he painted it, and then they showed him a .22 caliber rifle and a Saturday Night Special handgun, and said they needed to get rid of the rifle. and the truck had modifications done to the front and rear bumpers, like apparently George Bentley had made similar modifications to his truck before the trip. The mechanic's info looked good, and Easton was called Detroit Homicide and was making his plans to go to Detroit when Sergeant Baruta from Clearwater Detachment called him. What information did Sergeant Baruta have from the Clearwater Detachment? What had happened? What was found?
Well, a couple of forest rangers had came in and reported it, that they had saw, again, another burnt-out vehicle. And so when he checked the license plates of that, he realized it was the truck and probably the camper, but initially they weren't sure. It was so burnt out. And so he called Easton and told him, this is it. You've got to come back. I think we found it. And Easton couldn't believe it. He really thought he was on to the right characters, and they certainly did sound like the people you would think would be involved in something like this. Like it just had too many parts that were connected, and it sounded right on, but it wasn't. And you know, and it's true, they received well over 1,200 tips. I heard it was just over 1,300 from one of the police guys later. That, and the thing is, when they receive these tips, people actually have to review them and make sure that they're good or no good. So it does take up a lot of resources and a lot of time to go through this. So I know that they got a bad time for, at the time especially, for not necessarily doing, let's say, a good job. But I think they did a really good job for the amount of manpower they had and how much was going on. So yeah, that was so that was a big break. They had found it.
Yeah, you write though that there was criticism in the community, and especially there was an RCMP, recently retired RCMP homicide detective, Norman Lee, had conducted weeks of his own investigation, and he claimed that later, police ignored the fundamentals of the homicide investigation, and he criticized the original search, said it was haphazard, done in piecemeal. Instead of centralizing in the area of the park, he figured that that the police had been distracted by the reports of the French-Canadian duo. And so he thought it was hard to believe that a murderer would take the time and trouble to hide the bodies in the truck and then drive across Canada in such a distinctive vehicle. Regardless, as you mentioned, this was a big break, October 18th, 1983. This is a big break for Easton and German and the other detectives. So now they are going to concentrate on door-to-door canvassing of Clearwater and the Wells Gray areas. And I guess maybe they might have took Norman Lee's criticism to heart. They said this time they'd be contacting every single homeowner, going to every single house.
Yeah, I think they were really feeling the pressure. I think that the media and everybody was sort of starting to get on their case, and I think Easton was really under pressure to do something. So this wasn't the first time they canvassed. This was going to be the third time they canvassed in Clearwater. But they were going to do it more thoroughly and not leave any unknocked doors unanswered type thing. So if there was nobody there, they would actually go back until they got someone at every single residence. So it was a totally different time on the third round. This was very important because they really had to find an answer and to figure out where this all came from. And you got to realize, with both vehicles, the way they were found and the locations they were found, it was kind of a sure bet that whoever it was that had done the killings knew the area. They knew the back roads. They knew where they were and how to get back home. And you know, so it was someone from that area, someone that had lived in Clearwater or area, was still living there now. So that was kind of in their mind. It had to be someone local.
Let's stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about the canvas, and the name of David Shearing was first brought to police attention from an informant. And they had heard a story about what? Tell us what this informant had told them about something that had happened a few years before on the Wells Gray Highway.
Well, there was a story that what had happened was a younger guy had been run over and killed. And they had heard the story that it was David Shearing that was responsible for that. And there was also the gossip that it was a drug deal gone bad. There was just a lot of kind of unsavory talk about him as a character and what he had done to this guy and how he got away with it. And so someone that had a sort of, they were a little disgruntled or for some reason didn't like David Shearing at the time, decided to use that to get something and inform the police about this incident that had happened.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was another detective, actually an officer, Haslett, involved in the canvassing. And they went to a person's trailer, and they asked the gentleman there, you may have heard, we found the truck that belonged to the Bentleys. And the man, as you write, yeah, I heard. And the woman asked, is that the one up by Trophy Mountain? And the man scolded his wife for talking. He said, he's talking to me. And they said, well, we're wondering if you saw anything suspicious. And then this man is really gruff with these officers and said, I told you guys, I haven't seen anything like that. So they said, what about you, ma'am? And the man said, and you write, the man answered for her, said, no, nothing. We're not going to tell you any more than whatever we've told you. That's all we're going to tell you. And so they just bided their time for a little bit more and gave him a card and said, if anything happens or if you know anything, give us a call. Maybe not expecting much. Then they put the trailer under surveillance. Why did they put the trailer under surveillance, and what did these cops do once the husband went out for a ride?
Well, they put it under surveillance because they had heard the female, the wife or girlfriend, say, you're not going to tell them about David and the truck that he got shot up? And so when they heard that, the officer knew that he better not push it because he knew the man didn't want to talk. And so, yeah, they put it under surveillance and they waited. And when the husband was gone, they had approached her when she was alone. And that's when she kind of told them that about the truck and about how Shearing had approached her husband, her boyfriend, about fixing a bullet hole in the truck door. And he asked him a few other things about insurance and if he could kind of get rid of the number, the VIN number on the truck, and how if he could reinsure it without one and stuff like that. It's just kind of shady stuff. And so they knew that the Shearing had something to do with it. And so, but now what they had to do was get that information from the actual husband or boyfriend. So actually, this is something later what happened was that same guy, that husband, was out drinking in one of the bars, and they waited for him to start driving, and they arrested him on a DUI, and they made a deal with him to get the information. So that's how that was the real deep story of how they got that.
Yeah, but there was initially an incredible break from that woman that couldn't, according to her husband, hold her tongue.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
Yeah, that's it. You know, and they had a huge fight over that and broke up, and it was just a real mess.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, it was terrible, terrible situation. Just for really kind of, trying to tell the truth and you know, It's just a terrible situation that someone would want to protect a killer like that.
Well, I don't even know if we wanted to protect me, but he wanted to protect himself at that moment because, this guy, Shering, had asked him stupid stuff like, how to get rid of this serial number, but also how to maybe fix a bullet hole. So, pretty incriminating stuff. And the woman couldn't keep that to herself. So they do an investigation afterwards. They want to find out who this David Shering is. Obviously, they look up if he has a criminal record, but he lived on his father's 160-acre hobby farm. His father, tell us what his father does for a living. They also have a hobby farm, and Shering had lived on this place till almost his whole life, except for 4 months of his life. So tell us what his father's occupation is.
Well, actually, his father had worked at the prison originally and was a prison guard or, that. There was another name for what he did, but he worked with prisoners in the prison. And so he was law enforcement, you might say. They lived on the farm and he went to school. He had a fairly normal school life. He didn't really get into any trouble. His mother, she actually got really sick around this time or just before this time and ended up being put in a hospital, long-term care hospital originally. So, and he had a brother and a sister. He had a few girlfriends. He was a pretty normal person as far as the area of the Clearwater area, small town, did all the things he fit in just fine. Nothing stuck out.
You write that Shering was living on his dad's farm when his dad died of a heart attack in spring of 1982. His sister married and remained in the area, and David's brother became a deputy sheriff with the provincial government doing prisoner escorts and court security duties in Prince George. You write that in fall of 83, Shering moved to Tumbler Ridge. Now, tell us a little bit about this, as you write, about Tumbler Ridge and the kind of work that he thought he would surely be able to get there.
Well, Tumbler Ridge was a fastly growing town. It was under construction 24/7. He thought he would get a job up in construction. There were a lot of camps around Tumbler Ridge, and one was called Dog Patch, and that's initially where he was. And he was doing odd jobs, but he kept getting fired from his jobs. He didn't last long. And you got to realize this area, when I talked to a lot of the police that worked out of Dawson Creek who took care of this area, a lot of people that would go to Tumbler Ridge in the area for work were ex-prisoners and people that couldn't get jobs. And so people were getting hired in these construction sites with no real reference. So it was easy to get a job if you had, fairly decent, strength to you and stuff like that. But he still couldn't keep a job there. So what he did was him and a few of his buddies decided to build a makeshift little cabin up there. From wood that they stole from construction sites. Never worked out for them.
And so what did they do to survive if they weren't getting the part-time jobs? They were only getting part-time jobs, and of course they didn't have enough money. They didn't want to pay the dues to these little places where probably charging a lot of money for a little trailer. So how did they make ends meet?
Theft. But it was a combination, mainly theft. What they would do is they'd go to construction sites and steal equipment, and they would sell it. And so that was kind of the main source of income for them. And there was also some drug activity. with some of the people he lived with, selling drugs and supplying that sort of thing. So they kind of made it however they could. But it was all from illegal activity. And they eventually, he eventually got arrested for it as well, for theft and I think $40,000 theft, and got convicted of that. So, you know, he was living that way. And he also had a terrible habit of threatening people. Even one of the, when, before he made that cabin, one of the places he was staying at, he threatened to kill the manager and burn down the place because he had just asked him for his rent. People were kind of scared of him as well. He was not like a friendly person up in that area. He was not well liked.
Mm-hmm. You write about another important detective here, or RCMP, Ron German, and he landed in Tumbler Ridge, BC, in September '82. Or pardon me, he we're talking about Tumbler Ridge, BC, September '82. And he sees a yellow Ford pickup passing him on the road, loaded with tools. Intuitively, he figures he's going to stop them. And so you mentioned this stop. And when he stopped these two guys, the driver got out of the car and headed towards them. He said, that's always kind of dangerous, so he put his big floodlights on. So that would kind of stop the person in their tracks. And he asked for the driver's license. But he was very fidgety and nervous, and he asked about the tools. Now, what else did this Officer German do and see with the people that were with, as we know now, David Schering?
Well, I think the big thing was, he had seemed really nervous and fidgety and all that. So what he did was he put him in the back of his car, and the big thing he really noticed was the two passengers, the guy sitting in the middle and the guy sitting on the passenger side door, wouldn't look back. They faced mm-hmm. forward, and the whole commotion and the talking and the lights and all that stuff, they never moved. They wouldn't, you know, not at all. And so I think it kind of I think he said to me his spidey senses were tingling. He approached the car from the right side and snuck up on them and put his gun through the window and told them to freeze. Now, those two guys had a rifle aimed at the driver's side, thinking that the Officer German would come up to the that side and they were going to shoot him. They were, one guy had the rifle cocked and ready and laid across the other guy's legs. And, if he would have went to the wrong door, he would have been shot. A terrible situation. Now, and that's a very important thing that I bring up later. Actually, Germaine brought it up to me because he's one of the most important people in this whole case. He's one of the most important policemen in this whole case, and he's really the one that drove this home in a lot of ways that are very important. And even for the parole coming up, he's a very important person in this case. So that was it. So they were going to try and kill him. He ended up arresting them, getting them cuffed and out of the car, and he never got shot.
It's interesting, too, because he decides to take him back to the station and, I guess, ask his superiors to charge him for attempted murder, considering the loaded weapon was in the lap and you could not deduce anything else. Now you talk about Germaine again, if that's the pronunciation of his name. And so two nights later, what happens is that next day after they examine the truck with the tools, he gets a call about a burglary, a theft of tools. So now they know they better go see David Schering now, and they're looking for this cabin. So they go to Schering's cabin, This is a couple days later, and who is there from the other previous night, and what are these guys doing? What's the reaction once they see the police there? What do these guys do?
Well, yeah, because initially he let Sharon go, just so you know, because Sharon had no wants and warrants at the time, and they didn't know the tools were stolen, so that's why there was a couple of days there. But yeah, when they came to it, of course, him and his buddies were there, and they ran, and they had to chase them through the bush, and they did catch them out there. But again, another important part was that, because then when he went to go into the cabin, the third guy was there, and he was sitting in the corner again with a rifle ready to shoot. So, you know, the whole thing, it was just unsavory right from the beginning. But it was the same guy that Fred White, who had Germaine had booked for the attempted murder, and they had let him go, so they didn't keep him in. So here we go. It was quite a frantic chase as well. And he came with another officer, so there was two of them. So it's important to know it just wasn't him.
It's very interesting, and I think important, and I don't know if the courts, well, we'll talk about this, but you talk about that the officer was smart enough to know, he was experienced enough from the previous two nights before. So he said, oh, we're going to go into that cabin. He said, you can't make me go in that cabin. Again, your intuition would be that maybe there's something in that cabin. So then he puts Sharing in front of him like a shield, and then Sharing is screaming out to whoever's in there, hey, Willie, it's me, like, don't shoot. And of course he has a weapon in there, like, you're right. So again, these guys, for I don't know, to defend themselves against being, I don't know, ripped off or arrested, it seems like, it doesn't matter if It seems like they were ready. If they were going to be arrested, or if somebody were going to confront them, they'd shoot to kill these guys. So,
yeah.
Very interesting that the one not even considered, again, one officer figured, well, no, I don't think there's enough grounds for attempted murder. But 2 days later, these guys are acting again like they're very, very capable of it.
Yeah, that's that's an important point to think about. Later, when you talk about parole and about someone being eligible to get out on parole, just how capable of killing someone they are.
Now, you write that as well, is that the thing that they need now, they've also got this 3,000-watt generator, and then they have another reason so that they can visit Sharing again. They use some ruse, basically, to say, are you going to come into court on Monday? And he says, yeah. And they say, well, what are you going to plead? And he says, guilty. And then when they left, of course, they spotted the generator. They looked in the back of the truck, and they said, well, we'll leave this alone for later. Germaine called Eastham, and they were coming into Dawson Creek the next day. So Sharing was released. He was put on surveillance, but him and his buddy got on a bus to go to Tumbler Ridge. Now, Eastham calls Germaine to go there and get Sharing for questioning, but they don't want to let on what they really believe they suspect him of doing. So what does Eastham tell Germaine to do, how to approach Sharing?
Well, you know, he wanted him to be able to get Sharing back to the detachment for them so they could interview him, but he had to do it without letting him know that it was anything to do with the Johnson-Bentley murders. So he didn't want to give him any sort of a clue. He had to kind of trick him into coming in, which I, you know, that was quite a thing to ask of another officer,
Sure.
and it's like, well, you know, hey, that's pretty risky, but you've got to do this somehow. This, because knowing what kind of a person he is by now, like, you know, he already knows that this is, you know, this is a guy that possibly killed the Johnson Bentley families as well, if he tried to kill him twice. And he may have ran over some other guy. So in his mind, this is not a nice guy, right?
Yeah.
So he had to trick him into coming back and tell him it was about his problem of parole and theft, and about the other thing that had happened earlier. So he said, if you don't come in and straighten this out, they'll probably come out and have to get you, type thing. So it just sort of, he just tricked him into coming.
And when Jermaine did, he brought him down to Dawson Creek, and or pardon me, it was Dawson Creek or Tumbler Ridge, what we're talking about now. But what he does is that he is able to intimidate him and put this. He has this perfect balance. He says that he needs to intimidate him enough into talking, but not enough to ask for a lawyer. So it's Eastham and Ken. Libel. And so they start in with the good things in life, where he was born. So they have, Eastham has a real approach. And as you write, he, I don't know if he befriends him, but he certainly has a technique to be able to get Dave to do this. And you describe this in the book. You have all the conversations. What are some of the things that he plays upon? Is it religion, his mother? What, how does he get to him? How does he try to get to him?
Well, I think the key thing was talking about his mother, and kind of connecting with him on certain key things like that, like his mother, that really meant something to him. What, you know, how his mother would think or what she would do and how she is and where she is, and so he wanted to befriend him in that way. If that makes sense, kind of get him on a kind of a one-to-one basis, and we talk about things, and then he could slowly bring in some of the crimes, and then whenever Sharon was kind of upset or needed him calmer, he could bring back something like that. Family was really important to Sharon at the time. And he knew that that was a thing to focus on, and I think that was the one key thing, more than any of the other stuff. I think it was his mother.
He also knew and played upon the fact that his father had died, and he sensed that the passing of his father was an important event in his life, so he played upon that. He also talked about honest. He says, I know you're an honest guy. I know you're a good guy. So we've seen that before, but it was real masterful in this, in terms of very, very subtle, and he was very patient with him. And so he said, let's see if you're an honest guy. So when he says, let's see if you're an honest guy, what does he talk about? Again, the Wells Gray Road. What does he talk about? What does he bluff and tell Sharing he knows about this?
Oh, you know, he wanted to bring up the guy that he had run over, and that event that had happened and why it happened, and he could, and so that what that did was that brought a big relief to Sharing, because he thought, oh, this is what I'm here to talk about, right? And so it kind of put him at ease. It didn't, you know, because in the background, the Bentley Johnson murders had just hit a lot of news and a lot of talk and stuff like that, and had been mentioned a lot on the news. And it's so much so that when Sharing had gone in that month to sign his probation slip, because he was on probation for the thefts, he had to go in and see German and sign every month. It was on the news when they were together in the police detachment and they even talked about it. So it was on his mind. It was on a lot of people's minds at the time. So this put him at major relaxed ease, and all of a sudden he thought, wow, okay. And so then it became, about running over a guy and how it was an accident. And he played on that. Yeah, we know you're honest, and it was you didn't mean to do that. So he would do that and draw him in. So that was kind of a way of putting him at ease.
Yeah, it's interesting. What he did too is he let him into the let's see if you're an honest guy, and then he admitted to the hit and run, but said he was innocent. He just ran over him, but said he was drinking, so that's why he didn't go to police. Made a lot of sense. He cried as he wrote out the statement. They got him tissues. And so they were very, very sympathetic. He asked if he was going to jail, and they said, well, I don't know. It's up to prosecutors. But they did. He did start, do you believe in God, Dave? And Dave said no. But they said, does your mom? And he said, well, not really. But they said, well, does she believe in principles? And he said, yes. So they started with that, and once they got that full confession from him from the Wells Gray Road hit and run, I guess what's awful they do is they take a break and they go for coffees and they take a little, and then they're back in the room. Now, he's also talking, giving him an out and telling him, things happen, people do stupid things, I was stupid, things can happen, lots of things are stupid. But the tone changes eventually in that room. Again, he has to keep that balance to not get him to call a lawyer, ask for a lawyer, so he cautions him. But what changes in that room? How does the direction change in terms of the questioning now?
Well, they were kind of taking one step at a time and going further into it. And then they were taking their breaks and slowly getting him into it. But then it was time to, talk about the Johnson and Bentley family and what had happened and what he could talk about. I put as much of the detail in from East Ham as I could. From his point of view in this in this particular part of the book, after the hit and run, we get into the how did you come across the family or where did you see them and things like that.
Right. He talks about asks him first, where did you first see the family? Then what was the next thing you did? And then he asks them, do you know where they were killed? He asks them first, do you know where the truck was found? Do you know where the bodies were found? Do you know, or pardon me, he knew where the trucks were found. Yes. Do you know this? Yes. Then he asks them, do you know where they were murdered? And then he said Bear Creek. And you write, nobody knew that at that time. The RCMP had not reported on that. Let's put it that way. The public didn't know that anyway. Correct?
Yes, and that was kind of helping him confirm that, that they've got the man. But he knew that he couldn't go too far with the question. He knew he couldn't, he had to kind of keep bringing him back and forth with being friend and it's okay and you're a good guy and don't worry about it and asking him questions outside and then getting more out of him. A piece at a time.
Yeah, it's remarkable what you write that East Ham does. He says, don't make me involve your mother. You know we'd come for you. And then this guy starts crying. He says, yes. He says, I know you're not that kind of person, David. And finally, the pressure mounts and David Sharing blurts out, I could flip and shoot myself. Leave me alone in this room and I'll take care of it. And then yet, East Ham's approach, reaction after that is what? How does he treat him after? What are the kinds of things he says to him after?
Well, you know, again, you know, he was trying to make him believe that it doesn't have to end his life, and that he is a good person, and that we all make mistakes. He kept doing that back and forth, and that he didn't have to kill himself, and it was just kind of that back and forth, I think, right through. Like I said, I put most of the details in that of how he approached it and the words he used, and so it's an interesting thing to read through the details.
Mm-hmm. He is screaming now, "Oh God!" And so he's got him broke down. Eastham's got him in that room. He's saying, "It's difficult for us, Dave. Will you help us out?" And then Shering asks, "What if I tell you?" Said, "Well, you'll be charged with murder. You'll be in custody. And a psychiatrist," I thought this was brilliant, "a psychiatrist will have to check you out to see why you did it." And then they asked him where the gun was, and he told him it was at the ranch. And then he drew a series of maps, didn't he? Indicating all kinds. He drew four different maps. So everything they asked him to do, to document, he put on a map. So the next thing was to go and reenact the crime. So they took him to reenact that crime in that park, didn't they?
Yeah, and that was important. It's important to get them to write down things as much as possible. It's something you can use as evidence that, you know, of their knowledge of things and where things are, and 'cause you never know how it works in court, if certain parts of what they say and do gets included or not. There's all sorts of technical issues. So they wanted to get down to him drawing things himself and writing things out himself. So he did the maps. And then they flew down to Kamloops and drove over to the Clearwater area and had him go through all of the steps in reenacting of what he did, how he did it, and what he did with the vehicles and all the details and stuff. Because there was still a question of some of the detectives were still not quite sure if he was alone or if he had help,
right,
maybe eliminating the vehicles and stuff like that. So there was that question out there that the detectives had. So they wanted to see if he could show them how he could have done all of this himself and what the details were. So that's an important part of you know, securing the evidence of the crime.
Certainly. And they took photos were taken of this reenactment, and again, used likely at trial or used at trial. Now, the trial was set for April 16th, 1984 in Kamloops. And Shering gets a good lawyer, Fred Katz, one of the very best in the province, and the prosecutor's Bob Hunter. But they're all readying for this very important case and potential trial. What happens with that prospect?
Well, they basically have, they had Eastham and the rest of the detectives in and said, "You did a great job, everything's great, we've got the man and we know this, but we won't be doing the trial. He's just going to, we're going to take a plea," basically, you know. So they were going to bargain for, the second degree murder charges and put him away. So that's kind of how it went. So it was a big letdown in that way. The cops really wanted to kind of go. They were really looking for the trial, you know.
Hmm. You write about the reality in Canada in 1982, and just recently, within the last 5 or 7 years, has this law been changed? Let's talk about the situation with six counts of second-degree murder. We can talk about why it's considered only second-degree murder, but also the reality in terms of sentencing and consecutive sentences in this case. What were prosecutors and police really looking at in reality?
Well, I think it's important to say that what happened was, at the time, it was sharing that was saying that he killed the family for the possessions, right? He wanted to steal their truck, camper, the boat, and a lot of their items. So at the time when they were convicting him, in their mind, he was killing for the theft. At that time, right, there was no evidence and no proof, or they didn't have any idea that what he'd done was kill the adults so that he could sexually assault the girls. So that wasn't on
right.
the table. So it puts it in a different light. So all of a sudden, you're convicting a man of 6 murders. And so, you know, the sentence tends to be life, and the judge can sentence whether or not, you know, it's 10, 15 years, you know, before you're eligible for parole, like they set that date. And also because all 6 murders happened at the same time, it would be served, you know, not consecutively, but concurrently. So it's all done at once. So if you killed 4, 6, 1, 2, it was done at the same time. So it, you get, that's it. You know, you can get life 6 times, but it's all served together. And if your parole date is set at 15 years, 15 years, you're up for parole. That's just how it's done. It's not necessarily fair or right, but that also brings up the point that when he admits later about sexually assaulting the girls, this is not a case where they can make him go into treatment for it, or he isn't, you know, if you think he's not a registered sex offender, right? He's never been convicted of it, right? So that's a huge hole in this case that's probably very, very important now that he's up for parole.
It's very, very interesting, too, when you talk about how good an attorney is that Sam, Katz is, the attorney Katz, but also his experience and his background probably enabled him to get as sweet a deal for sharing as possible, and that's what this looks like. He knows what the implications are for later, and despite having a person kill 6 people in Canada, I wouldn't bet against a person being released on parole. Now, in terms of this, the judge gave him the maximum that is allowed in Canadian law, 25 years before eligible for parole. The 6 sentences are served concurrently, but we're talking about 2020. So after 25 years, this person was going to have a parole hearing, and the families and the survivors, the family victims, families would have to relive this to a great extent again during those parole hearings. Detective Eastham, though, knew that there was more to this story. And so what did he do, and what did he vow to do with David Schering once the sentencing had been completed?
He had it, I guess somewhere with the experience, with the area, just something inside of him knew that there was more to it, that there was something else that Schering wasn't talking about, and he vowed to find out, and he said that he wanted Schering to tell the truth and to know this. So he went back in after things were settled, and he got to talk to him. And Schering told him kind of a truth. And I say that because he's had different stories over different times, but he did tell him about his sexual assault of the kids, and that he did kill the adults primarily to get at the kids. It wasn't about the boat and the motor and the camper or anything like that. It was nothing to do with that. So that's not even part of the case. That's just that was, you know, his defense in the original charges, but there was much more to it than that.
He admits that he sexually assaulted them and that his primary motive, once he had seen them, was to kill all these four adults to be able to get to these girls. But one was 11 years old, and he talks about them being, one of them, the young one, being a virgin at 11, not so surprisingly, but there's an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old. And so as we talked about earlier in the story, kind of just interrupting it, there is the truth about what really happened. And in your book, you write that Schering has told different stories, but one story he tells is representative of his warped psychology and his view about things that happened. He could be lying, but there is a certain window that we can see into this aberrant psychology of David Schering. Tell us some of the things he said in terms of how long this was and sort of the almost romantic nature of some of this, of his story.
Yeah, he's a strange character. He had, so it could have gone anywhere from a week to 13 days that he had the girls. And whether he assaulted them originally when he shot the parents in the tent or not is still up for, who knows. I sort of think that he did. I think he had done something. And then when he took them out and shot the father and all that. You see, in his story, to Eastham even, and when he was talking about having them in the car and driving, and they would do anything for him and they believed him. You know, he was telling them that bad guys had come into the camp and their adults had left to go get help. And he even pretended when he was back at his cabin to be talking to their father on the phone and things like that. So, and he said they believed everything and they would do everything for him. I sort of don't believe him. There's more to it than that, because, you know, the 13-year-old is not going to see you shoot the father and see the dead parents and drive with them in the car and be doing everything because you trust him and like him. There's something wrong with that story, but he didn't really change that much for me either. So I don't know. I think, and you also got to look at what he's doing as he's saying that he used to be, he's sort of suggesting he was abused. And what he does is he has fantasies about bondage with young children, like young girls, and tying them up and having sex with them. So, but he said that that's all gone. He's cured of that fantasy. They no longer happen, and it went away years ago. And therefore, he needs to get on with his own life, and he should be allowed to get out on parole, you know, because he's got a new wife now, and that sort of scenario. So he's kind of promoting that. But as Ron German said before, the cop, this is a man that ran over that other guy and killed him, and tried to kill this policeman twice for no reason other than to kill. There wasn't, he wasn't having fantasies. He wasn't trying to kill in these locations to get to a child because he had an uncontrollable fantasy. So this is, you have to realize that this is a man that is going to kill just for the fact of killing because he needs to for whatever reason. It's not about a fantasy. So even if you were to believe that he's cured of this sexual fantasy with girls, you know, it doesn't matter now. It's kind of this man should not be out, period. He doesn't deserve to be in public. And who would want him as their neighbor, you know? So I leave it at that as far as that goes. And one of the other things with him was that he's able to talk about abusing the younger girl because she didn't know how to do anything. is how he put it. That was his words. So basically, she wasn't sexually active. She didn't know how to respond. She didn't know how to do things with him sexually. So he was so upset, he said he shot her in the head. Of course, you know, the original story was, you know, he walked her in the woods after a week and did it. But it sounds like, from what I got, he did it almost within a day of getting back to the cabin. So it's who knows? It's somewhere in there. But to be able to just talk that way about an 11-year-old means that this man, there's something wrong with him. He does not need to be out in public. And I can't emphasize that enough. You know, he's sick, and I don't know how we can cure him. And even if he was cured, it doesn't alleviate the stress and what the family has to go through. And with these parole hearings, with each one that is going to come up every 2 years, they have to go through the whole thing and relive it as if it was yesterday. So it's not doing justice to the survivors. So it's wrong on a lot of levels.
It's lucky that all along the way, that this was not as cunning a criminal as he could be. And that's all I could give him credit for, is that luckily he's not that cunning or clever. And the things that he got away with at the trial in terms of just being recognized as the killer of those six people, without the establishment of the rape of these 11-year-old and a 13-year-old, so the pedophilic rape of these two girls as a motive, which in other jurisdictions would have been grounds for premeditation. It sure sounds like premeditation when you go back a couple days later with a rifle and then shoot everybody to get to the girls. So he luckily, again, he got lucky with his lawyer and just what happened at the trial with the plea bargain. Detective Eastham found out the truth to a certain great degree, but luckily this David Shearing, trying to get parole, is again trying to be honest, and he talks about the most twisted things, like he was a hero to those girls. They thought he was a hero from saving them from the bikers. And again, this idea that he was having some kind of relationship for any amount of days is something that would... What's happened with parole boards is they have not agreed to let him out. But I think it should be grounds for a parole board, again, like you mentioned, forever to prohibit him from ever getting out. Now, when we talk about parole, there was a woman named Tammy Arishinkoff, and she had gone to school with Janet. They went to the same school. And after this murder and all of these subsequent years, she has been affected. So when we talk about parole, and I had her on the program years ago about this very subject of trying to get a petition and doing that and trying to get to make sure the public knew and put pressure of some sort on the parole board not to release David Shearing. So tell us a little bit about the parole hearings and Tammy Arishinkoff.
Yeah, I think that I think people have to look at, a lot of times the parole board is, and parole in Canada or even the U.S. for that matter, their success is judged by how they can rehabilitate. So getting people back out into, into common society. So if they're successful at getting people out and into the workforce and life force, that's considered good. So in their mind, they're trying to get, they're there to really help the criminal. And it sounds harsh this way, but that's really what they're there to do. They also say they're there to protect, you know, society. But there's a lot of pressure on getting these people out. And even to a fact that even if without a parole, there's a certain amount of time where you get out anyway. So it's an uphill battle. People like Tammy and family members have to write up their impact statement. They have to send it in. Quite often, as is with Tammy, it gets rejected because it might be considered too mean or too aggressive.
Right.
So they have to watch how they word things. And it's like, well, you know, you killed members of their family. You killed people. You've done some awful things. So they have some upset. They have rage. They have things they want to put out there. This is how you affected them. You've made them into this person. So that should be allowed. But, you know, they're very, you know, consistent with that. And the other thing is when you go to the hearing as well, you know, he doesn't have to face the victims or the victim family. It's not quite like what it is what you'd see on TV. So he gets
right.
to sit up on the nice parole board thing with his new wife and minister or whoever else he has on his side. So they sit there, they face the three-member board, and they answer the questions and they talk to the board, and that's how it goes. It can go anywhere from 1 to 4 days, depending on how much there is to read and talk and how many questions. So that's kind of what goes on. I think it feels kind of lackluster for the people of the family and friends that go to these because they don't get to face him and tell him what they think of him. And it's kind of watching from the sidelines. And I think it's very unfulfilling and it's more frustrating. And at the same time, they have to relive the whole event. The whole thing comes back to the day when it happened. And I think that's a struggle. And they've been through two of them. And the next one comes up next summer. I believe it's June, the third week of June. I don't know what the COVID, if things are changed because of that. But no. That's the date as far as I know.
And Tammy and her group will be there. And just to give credit to the parole board, they're not really mandated to let people out. It just looks like, it seems like that there are programs that people, after a bunch of years in prison, figure, I better go through these programs to show the kind of supposed remorse and change in their life. They have to do a fair amount to be able to be released on this parole. And there is no early parole for this person. It's 25 years, and it's not mandatory that he ever gets out. And from the other parole hearings that are done, it seems that have been completed, that he is not prepared in any way. So he's not, it doesn't seem close to me, but not that I would know. But having to relive it every 2 years is disturbing element of the Canadian judicial system. The change now is, I think, was welcome when you have the ability to charge or to put three consecutive life sentences together and then piece those 25-year eligibilities together, so in reality, in fact, that the perpetrator that killed three or more, I know it sounds, you know, you have to kill three, that you would get a 75 years before eligibility of parole. In essence, basically, that is a life sentence in Canada, now available in the last 5 or 7 years. So people don't have to go through this over and over again. Very much like the Bernardo case, those people have to again attend these parole hearings over and over again. So very disturbing.
Yeah, and I wasn't trying to make it sound like the parole board doesn't care or that not. I think what I'm trying to say is it in their minds, and the family mind, because the family and Tammy and all the people that show up, it's not like the parole board is there with them in a group and they don't feel part of
no.
it. I think that's it. Like they're not, it's not
yeah.
all like we're here and then they stand up and do their thing. It's almost like they're at a distance watching it from the sidelines and letting these three people that they don't know try to assess whether or not someone like Sharing can get out. And Sharing, I think, it has learned how to become better at staging parole because now he's, you know, he's married, he's got a name change, he just had all of those, the manslaughter from running over that guy, all of his drug charges and theft charges have all been taken off his record now. So he's applied
wow.
to remove all of that. He's taken all these courses, like you said. So he's kind of I think he's setting himself up to be in a place where he could get members of a parole board to kind of go, oh, yeah, he's been in prison 30 years. He's never had any problems in prison. He's had no write-ups. So he's got a good attendance. He's in a medium, mild, secure prison now. He gets to have 72 hours with his wife in a cabin on the property every month. So there's a lot. He's got a lot of loose restrictions in his life. And if he continues to be good and he has all of these things, and he's got a minister standing up for him as well, saying, you know, hey, this is a good, you know, he's found the Lord and he's good and all this. He's got a good soul. I'm just saying that he's working toward trying to get out in every way that he can.
Yeah, what's disturbing to me, too, is that I just read about he's eligible after the 25 years, which means now for the last bunch of years, he's eligible for unescorted passes, up to 15 of them a year, remarkably. And then, again, that, I believe, is used to demonstrate that this person, look, he's out in the community, he's safe.
Exactly, and that's what I mean by the system. It's set up in order to see, because they're trying to say that we're successful at getting, let's say, 40% of people out or whatever their number is, and having a very low turnover rate. So they're trying to work it that way. And he was approved for this pass, right, initially as well. And that was a big concern. Some of the friends that I talked to that now live in Calgary that were neighbors in Kelowna at the time are scared and didn't even want to be mentioned in the book, or they would give me information and say, well, you can't use my name because they're scared he's going to get out. And they'll, you know what I mean? So there's a real fear there, that just the idea of him getting out scares people. And the idea of him being allowed to come out for a day pass or a pass not escorted by guards, and knowing that they're in the area of where the prison is that he's in, it really scares them.
Yeah, it's a disturbing case, and I'm glad you added the reality of what happens post-conviction in Canada and what is happening today for people like Tammy Ryshkov, and the other families as well, and friends. So I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about this outstanding book, Murder Time 6, The True Story of the Wells Gray Park Murders. Thank you so much, Alan R. Warren, for this. Is there a website? I know that you are host of the excellent House of Mystery podcast every week. Tell us a little bit about of a website or how they might be able to take a look at this book.
Oh, yeah, my website is just alanrwarren.com, and that's one L, so alanrwarren.com. And you can get it, links you to the show, it links you to all the books. Everything's all in one now. So, and it links you to my Facebook, all social media, everything you need to know. And that's the one place. And of course, if you want, go to bookstores. This is out in all bookstores in US and Canada. And, of course, it's on Amazon and Kobo and all that as well.
Yes. Thank you so much, Alan Warren. Murder Time 6,
Thank
the
you.
True Story of the Wells Gray Park Murders. Thank you so much. You have a great evening. Good night.
You too.